Many years ago, a patient of mine whom I treated for breast cancer had a car accident. She had no particular problems with chemotherapy, but on questioning, admitted that she simply could not feel the pedals. It was exactly at that moment that I understood the real importance of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. I'm Bogda Kozwara, and this is Supportive Care Matters. My guests today are a pair of researchers from Sydney, Australia. Dr. David Goldstein is a medical oncologist and a professor at the University of New South Wales. Dr. Susanna Park is a scientist and associate professor at the Health, Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. Together, they lead a major multidisciplinary effort to improve management of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, or CIPN. David and Susanna, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be with you.
So, CIPN is something that perhaps is not very well known to the audience. So let's start with something basic. Can we have a bit of a definition of what chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy is?
Absolutely. So CIPN is nerve damage to the peripheral nerves, which is caused by chemotherapy treatment for cancer. So like other adverse events for cancer treatment, some therapies cause CIPN and others do not, but some very commonly used chemotherapies for common cancers, such as breast cancer, gynecological cancer, colorectal cancer, and blood cancers are affected by this form of peripheral nerve damage.
So is it common? One tends to think about nerve damage as something that would be important for a concert pianist, but does it matter for a regular person? And is it severe, not severe? How does that impact on patients?
So it really does matter. Clearly, we think even more so, and I do have a number of musicians that I have treated with CIPN-related drugs because that was the right thing to do. But we had very extensive conversations. One is a concert-level touring person. And so we had very extensive conversations about the pros and cons. And really, every person I work with ultimately wants the best treatment and they are willing to take the risks involved. But it affects everyday activities. It is not just about watchmakers and concert pianists, saxophonists, and in one other case, cellists. It's actually about people dropping cups because they can't feel them properly. It's about buttoning buttons. It's about using a keyboard and a smartphone. So it really is about daily activity and is important for everybody.
I think if we go into the key symptoms of CIPN, so it causes sensory predominant nerve damage. So this is things like tingling, numbness, pain in the hands and feet. But it's really, I guess, the functional consequences of these symptoms that are really a problem for patients. So people affected by CIPN report difficulty with their fine motor skills, as David said, doing up buttons, typing, texting, using the hands, but it also leads to prominent problems with the feet, problems with balance, gait, walking, and exercise. We know that these downstream effects affect sleep quality, ability to exercise, and we know that chronic CIPN reduces quality of life. I think one of the other key issues is that for some patients, it becomes chronic and persistent. And so you have a proportion of people, and the exact percentage will vary by the agent, but for something like oxaliplatin for colorectal cancer, you can have 30% of patients that are left with this moderate to severe chronic neuropathy symptoms, which can persist permanently, or at least for studies have shown out to, 15, 20 years post-chemotherapy treatment.
And that's the key, Bogda, that our work suggests, although we haven't quantitatively, definitively proven it, is people adapt. They go back to life, they reintegrate into society, but when you really question them, their adaptation includes limiting function. There's certain things. I have a particular colleague who was a very avid tennis player and basically stopped, and that was one of his major social activities. So if you just talk to them briefly, as unfortunately oncologists like myself tend to do because there's a pressure of number of patients. And if you talk to them briefly, oh, everything's fine and I'm doing really well, and that's it, right? But if you either get them to fill out a questionnaire before you see them, or you have the time and you have a bit of a chat, it suddenly becomes clear that it's adaptation, but it's somewhat maladaptive.
So really, that means that we need to be very good at assessing neuropathy, because you can't just sort of say that, well, do you have any tingling in your fingers? And that's enough, because you may not get those nuances of adaptation or maladaptation or potentially symptoms that may not be categorized as neuropathy. Absolutely. Can you give me sort of examples of how you would go about asking questions in a 15 minutes, 10 minutes that we might have on this particular task?
Absolutely. So as you've outlined, one of the key challenges we have is that there's a lack of a gold standard assessment tool. And we know that for many toxicities, but especially for CIPN, that if you ask clinicians to rate the level of neuropathy severity and then you ask the patients to rate the severity of their symptoms, you get very different outcomes. So patients are reporting higher severity symptoms than are reported by the clinicians. And some of this gap is, I guess, a lack of standardization in the questions that are available. So there are a lot of patient-reported outcome measures that can collect more of this information, but they're not currently routinely used in clinical practice. And I guess this is something that applies not just to CIPN, but across a whole range of cancer care. Our research has shown that even just a simple two-item questionnaire about the severity and impact of CIPN can dramatically improve the further conversation. So highlight to clinicians when they need to ask more questions or where there might be a problem. There are also longer, more in-depth questionnaires that look at more the functional impacts, and that can help identify the patients who might need other services. So I think like anything, there's a range of severity, and really critical is what we're now understanding is we need to find the patients that need the support. So who needs intervention with balance and gait, who needs intervention with pain management, who is having, you know, early and severe symptoms, so that those things can be mitigated. I guess in the absence of something that's neuroprotective, obviously that's one of the holy grails, is to find something that people could take or some preventative strategy. But I think even in the absence of that, before we've developed that, there's so much we can do today to improve identification of this toxicity, to improve management and triage of these patients just using routinely available tools. So I guess increasingly over the years of our collaboration, a lot of our research has now become focused on this implementation gap of how we can improve the situation for patients today, make it easy for clinicians to be able to improve the way we assess and manage toxicities. It's not an easy thing by any means, I guess, but yeah, it's a really important focus.
Susanna is an expert in neurophysiology. And she has an enormous number of tools that she can work with. And she's literally done hundreds of patients worth of objective nerve testing. And I'll let her expand on this, but it turns out that patient-reported outcomes almost better than, I hesitate to say this because Susanna will kill me because this is what her life's work is, all the in-depth testing, but almost as good in helping identify and triage as the in-depth testing, which is more, I think, has evolved to be an understanding of mechanism and an ability to start to think about what interventions would make sense therapeutically, right? And perhaps afterwards, but I'll get her to expand now.
Thank you, David. You make me laugh. It's true. My background is as a clinical neurophysiologist. And I think initially when we started our research program, I probably was guilty of thinking we can resolve this very quickly. We will do some nerve tests. We will prove that these objective nerve tests give us all the information we need, and then we will implement it and move on. But I guess as with anything, the real picture is so much more complicated and interesting perhaps, but our work has demonstrated, I would say definitively, that something like a patient-reported outcome where you ask people about the impact of their symptoms and the severity is more sensitive than an objective nerve test that we can do. And I guess one of the reasons for this is that when you ask someone these questionnaires, they're reflecting on what's important to them and they're reflecting on their function globally and the symptom impact. And when we're doing a nerve test, or even we do other tests which are quantifying sensory loss, looking at fine motor function, looking at balance and gait function. These are all really important research tools, but they're all looking at a component of this issue. So we're measuring nerve function at a few discrete sites. So I guess it makes sense that that is not going to be as sensitive as something when you're asking people about the impact and significance of this entire global issue for them, which affects many areas of their life.
So if I were to use an analogy here, for example, a person might have problems with neuropathy that affects their feet, but how well they walk will be affected by how well lit the corridor is and how good their vision is and how good their muscle strength is and whether they have a limp because of a sore hip or something like that. So in a way, the neuropathy is taken in context of the overall function, and they can be affected significantly even with moderate neuropathy if those other factors occur. Is that what you're talking about, or am I just making it up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Voktor, you're spot on. In fact, we've done some collaborative studies with scientists who measure gait and balance. And one of the interesting things that we found is that in normal challenge kind of environments, the gait is pretty normal. When you start to add a cognitive load, which is a fancy way of saying normal life, because you're very rarely walking without doing something else. So, you know, you're crossing a road, you're thinking about when you're going to cross it. Is the floor bumpy? What other things are happening? What are you going to have for lunch? What's for dinner? All of those things, when you have CIPN, it requires more of your attention and energy to maintain your balance, to visually guide where you're walking. And so our research found that if we add a cognitive load to a walking task, that's when we start to see these impairments that come out, sort of showing, I guess, the impact, how other factors in combination with the CIPN are what produces this functional disability.
So actually, this perhaps anticipates your question later, but it's definitely higher order issues, like in chronic fatigue syndrome, it's the same thing, that cognitive ability seems to be normal until it's challenged in a more discrete way, and then you uncover higher order functions that wouldn't be uncovered in your standard straightforward test. And the same applies here. So pain as a manifestation or sleep disorder, these other extra dimensions, another example of what you were saying that would influence the individual perception of their problem with the nerve disturbance.
So can I pick up on some of those symptoms? Because I think they're really relevant from the clinical perspective. I recall that in a very common way, the questions that oncologists would ask of patients looking for neuropathy is, do you have any tingling in fingers or toes and can you do up your buttons? But the symptoms that you have mentioned were pain and sleep disturbance. What are some of the sort of, let's say, less conventional symptoms that would alert you to the presence of neuropathy?
So from my perspective, the other things that I try and remember to do is ask about near misses, so not just falls, but nearly falling over, for example, would be another one. Yeah, it's always, remember, pain's a difficult one, because pain, as we normally think about it, like our patients with hepatic metastases and liver capsular pain, is not what this is about. True severe pain that requires narcotic analgesics is incredibly rare. Mm. Even pain that requires intervention with non-steroidals, for example, is uncommon, 1 in 5. But that discomfort of pins and needles is extremely common. It's a problem that makes people disturbed and not functional, especially at night. They hate it at night. Bedclothes covering these hypersensitive toes, but Susanna's going to make it more scientific as usual.
I think what David's pointing out, so certainly there are significant numbers of people with CIPN affected by pain. However, it's not the majority and it can vary by agent. So in our studies, it's usually around 25% to 40% of people with CIPN will also report neuropathic pain. So neuropathic pain is a particular type of pain, usually characterized by sort of burning, sharp sensations as compared to other types of pain which are more conventionally managed inflammatory pain, things like non-steroidals. So neuropathic pain, there's a whole, I guess there are pharmacological therapies that are used, including things like duloxetine and other strategies. There are some trials for duloxetine demonstrating benefit for people with pain, so that 25% of people and CIPN. However, I think there's still a lot more work to do to identify if there are, which pharmacological strategies are better for people. But certainly things like numbness and non-painful tingling or paresthesia, there's no pharmacological agent that has been demonstrated to improve those symptoms. So I think, to me, pain in CIPN is really important. So we have a recently published study which demonstrates that the people who report pain, so that 25%, they typically have worse CIPN and they are more than two times as likely to report sleep disturbance. They are more than two times as likely to report exercise intolerance, and they are more than three times as likely to report that they've tried to seek some treatment for their symptoms. So really, while it's not the majority, that's a really important group to pay attention to, perhaps to refer them on to other pain management services or to try to implement different interventions to improve their quality of life, while recognizing that there are other people who have a lot of severe symptoms that maybe are not painful. I guess a lot of what we can do today to improve management for CIPN is based on grouping patients into these smaller groups. So it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, and trying to figure out what do we have that can support these patients today, such as, you know, physiotherapy or pain management approaches.
And that segues quite nicely, Bogdan, into our current big project that you're a part of, which is a health implementation project to do exactly that, to refine and triage and improved identification, and therefore getting the right treatment for the right patient, right? Precision medicine. So appropriate analgesics for that 25%, exercise physiology perhaps for a different group, sleep disorder for yet another group, but really refining it for practice to help people like us a triage appropriately and get people help early rather than now, where often it's really a long time, if ever, before they get some assistance that's appropriate.
So let's unpack that implementation challenge. And I would imagine it starts with the assessment. And what I've heard so far is that there are tools, both laboratory tools and PRO, patient-reported outcome collection tools, that would identify presence of neuropathy, but they're not necessarily applied in clinical practice, not used in clinical practice as such. What are the reasons for that?
I think you're right. It's, I guess with any of these issues, it's complex. I think it's unfair to say that it's because people don't want to assess CIPN. I think it's really having the right tools and being able to seamlessly integrate it into the clinical workflow. And this is probably something that is going to be different for different centers and even for different doctors. So it's got to really be something that is fit for purpose. We've recently completed a pilot implementation study at two centers. And the way that which was just to implement a short CIPN screening questionnaire, the way it was implemented even between two different hospitals in the same city was completely different. And I think that's really informed our upcoming project, which is to work with implementation scientists to really unpick this, because I think perhaps foolishly, we sort of thought, this is a short questionnaire, we can just whack it into clinical practice. How hard can it be? Exactly. I see you've been there too, Bogda. But I guess what you need to think about is CIPN doesn't happen in isolation. You know, these are people having ongoing cancer care. They've got a lot of consideration. There's other toxicities. There's other issues for them. It's very unreasonable to expect that CIPN should have a lengthy consultation time. It's not practical. So what we want is something that really integrates seamlessly, ideally also getting patients on board so that they can understand what symptoms would be of concern and can help guide those conversations with their oncologist and other clinical personnel so that there's less confusion over what you should report and when and what the outcome might be.
So I just want to say it sounds good. Susanna talks the talk beautifully, but the problem is the implementation. And that's why we're really pleased to have a very experienced implementation group who understands the physical and emotional barriers and time barriers within the system, and that are really going to help us from their previous experience in other areas, including in general practice, actually, with asthma, for example. What are the effective ways, and how do you engage health professionals in that and patients so that they facilitate it happening seamlessly?
I think one of the challenges in assessing patients' needs is that the tools often are developed for one particular symptom, and the tool in itself in isolation is not particularly complex or challenging. But when you think about it, where you have 2 minutes for CIPN, 2 minutes for cardiotoxicity, 2 minutes for fatigue, 2 minutes for anxiety and depression, and 2 minutes for sexual needs, and maybe something else, financial toxicity, et cetera, before you know it, the poor patient is faced with, you know, a battery of 20 minutes of tests, which might be a challenge. So I think that there is a need for us to figure out how we integrate that assessment. And perhaps this is where patient-reported outcomes come into it, because patients can prioritize what's most important to them.
Absolutely. I think that's really the way forward, because, you know, patients are they know what affects them. They know what their top issues are. Certainly, there are some PROMs developed which are trying to be more broad and pick out those kind of issues. But I guess one of the great things about working in this area has been the people you meet over the years working on other areas and seeing these commonalities, how we can work together, because these things don't happen in isolation.
David, there is a view, and I don't know whether that reflects a reality or a myth in clinical practice. So I want to ask you, as an oncologist, that for some toxicities, and CIPN could be one of them, there might be a reluctance on the part of clinician to ask because they don't know how to fix CIPN if they discover it. And there might be a reluctance on a part of a patient to admit it because there's a fear that if CIPN is discovered, then the solution is to stop the drug that potentially could be beneficial in terms of treating the cancer. Is that something that is kind of imaginary, or is that a real problem? And if so, how would you manage it?
No, it's extremely real. When we did some work on sexual function about 10 or 15 years ago with a PhD student who's now a medical oncologist with an interest in survivorship, it became very clear that it was something that was almost never mentioned. And also that when it was actually asked, or when patients were asked independently, it was a problem that they also had reluctance to engage with practitioners about. So you are absolutely right. And by the way, despite that research, I still don't do it as well as I should. And I've actually been involved with it. And so it's a problem, and it's the question of implementation. It's about how to do it in a non-confronting, comfortable way. And that's true of chronic fatigue syndrome as much as it is sexual function, as much as it is neuropathy. And how to do it in a comfortable way is a challenge I certainly have not worked out yet. But I hope with CIPN we might start to think about that, and from that learn for perhaps more challenging topics how to move in that direction as well.
I think from my perspective as a non-clinician, I guess people that are not clinicians might be surprised that even currently there's quite a high rate of dose reduction and premature stopping of chemotherapy due to neuropathy. So, you know, in our breast cancer, early breast cancer paclitaxel cohorts, you know, 30% have some modification to the paclitaxel simply because of neuropathy. So this is already something which is impacting on intended cancer treatment. I guess from my perspective as a scientist, what I would like is to be able to offer better information to the clinicians so that it can inform that decision making. Obviously, it's not a black and white decision, but I think currently the information that clinicians have available to help them make these decisions, particularly in terms of how is this going to affect the patient potentially longer term into that post-treatment phase, that's where we can really provide better information to inform those decisions, I guess, that are already happening on a daily basis.
And it sets the research agenda as well, led by patients as well as clinicians, because it says there's a chronic problem that's significant. And in fact, in our surveys, it was the second most common problem survivors talked about in a 1,000-patient survey that we did after fatigue. So it sets a research agenda, and it also helps you start to think about, well, what are the interventions? So, you know, the nirvana would be therapeutic prevention. No such luck for 20 years of trying, including several randomized trials we did that we were certain was going to be the answer. And then for established CIPN, what might work? Neuropathic drugs, enhanced nerve functioning, or other interventions like exercise, and what sort and what dose of exercise. So thousands of questions come up for which clinical research is possible to answer them.
Is there a particular need to design research in a particular way? You already mentioned input from patients. It seems to me that long-term outcome monitoring would be important because you would want to know how long it takes before CIPN resolves or not. What are the challenges of designing research or funding research in that area?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, long-term studies don't fit the funding model that we have, which is sort of discrete and shorter-term funding available for studies. But I think obviously it's critical to know what happens long-term, and that's something that's of great interest to patients and clinicians as well. I think in terms of designing the studies, a really critical factor has been outcome measure selection. So there's already been lots and lots of trials of potentially neuroprotective strategies, and we've often been let down by the outcome measures, which is not to say that these strategies would be successful, but we really need to set ourselves up in the best possible way to be able to demonstrate if something's effective or not. If you can't measure change in neuropathy accurately and sensitively, you obviously can't measure if an intervention is going to be successful. So in recent years, there's been a lot more international collaborative work sort of outlining what the key outcome measures are, what should be included. And it's typically thought to be a combination of different types of assessment tools. So obviously, increasingly, patient-reported outcome measures are very important for some types of studies, particularly if you're trying to demonstrate neuroprotection, then it's also optimal to include something more objective so you can see at what level is this intervention working? Is it preventing nerve damage? And there's a lot of new and emerging types of techniques that can help us measure non-invasively the development of axonal damage. I think another important element, yeah, is including patients in this and ensuring that their perspective is included on what they think is important as outcome measures. Because even if we use a patient-reported outcome measure, if we pick up a certain symptom as being the most important for them, and we don't consult them, we may be off the mark in terms of reducing the impact. I think also David briefly mentioned exercise, and we and other groups have done a bit of work in this area. As you know, obviously, the role of exercise in oncology care has taken off in many, many different directions. But I think there is promising initial evidence that this has a great effect. And even if this is not a specific effect to neuropathy, we have evidence that it's, you know, improving patients' function, it's improving patients' quality of life. And I think this is also something, particularly if we're able to give people more specific guidelines on what they can do, that's really empowering for patients. We have a lot of patients come in from our studies that sort of feel that this is a problem that's not dealt with, that it's put in the too hard basket, and then there's nothing that they or anyone can do to help them. They tend to get referred to the research because that's the only option available to them. So at least having something that they can practically manage, I think, has a really big impact on people's lives.
And Bogda, in partial response to your question about funding and type of funding, I think Suzanne and I have to give credit to the Cancer Institute New South Wales because they do have these five-year programmatic. Here's a problem. Here's a request for applications to look at this problem holistically. And we were fortunate enough to get involved in such funding for 5 years. And that's why we have some of the questions that we now have because we're able to do that, including long-term 5-year. Through those 5 years, we were able to set up a cohort and follow them and get some idea of timing. It's a bit sad that, you know, we couldn't maintain that cohort after our funding had gone, but in a way, we sort of have a bit. But my important point is that it was multidisciplinary. It was epidemiology. It was mechanism. It was preclinical models. And it was therapeutic interventions. We're able to cover all of that because it's a holistic 5-year sort of funding. The US has these things called SPOR grants, which are similar and longer term. And I think there's room for that to become more national. I think the Cancer Institute has really demonstrated in several different areas that this is a good idea that has its role.
Because what you're describing now is a very rich program of research that has generated evidence in a lot of areas, but it's also identified some key priorities for future research. And I remember very well, before that time, CIPN was one of those topics that nobody wanted to study because you didn't even know where to start, and you had no obvious solutions to offer to patients. So it wasn't exactly a sort of a hip area to get into. And now it's so much more advanced, and you've listed some key elements that are required to get to that point. I think there is a lesson in it for other aspects of supportive care or cancer survivorship or both.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think one of the key lessons, as David highlighted, is getting people from different professional backgrounds involved. That's been one of the really great joys of our program, coming from different perspectives and then collecting large numbers of different types of people across whole fields of research and getting their perspective. You know, how can we look at the health economic aspects of this problem? You know, how can we look at the genetic aspects of this problem? There's lots of different areas that this can help us uncover how we can assist patients.
And having all those people in the same room, including affected patients as well, generates all sorts of new ideas. You know, preclinical scientists who say, I didn't really understand what this meant for patients. Maybe we could design a different neurophysiology model in mice that would answer that question better. As Suzanne, it's a joy to every, what did we do it? 3 times a year, we were all in one room together from so many for a day. And so where are we up to? Everybody would present their data and then discuss it in a group from all 360 degree perspective. It's really a wonderful thing.
And I think despite all this great progress, there's a lot more to do and a lot we still don't know. And in fact, chemotherapy-induced neurotoxicity was selected this year as one of the grand cancer challenges by the National Cancer Institute and Cancer Research UK, as saying this is a tough challenge that requires multidisciplinary impact, many people to come together to still resolve this issue, and particularly in terms of designing something that could protect the axons from this damage.
So what are the next steps for your research in CIPN?
I think there's, as I said, a lot more to do. Part of our work is now focuses on implementation. So how can we improve clinical practice now? As David mentioned, we've developed a clinical pathway designed for Australia. So how we can improve screening and management of CIPN. We did a Delphi study with 70 multidisciplinary colleagues to get consensus on this pathway. And so part of our project is now working with implementation scientists for how we can implement that. I think we're also trying to improve how we can identify patients at risk of this toxicity. So despite all this research, the specificity of clinical risk factors is still quite low. So we know that broadly, people who are older, people who have higher BMI, people who have comorbidities are more at risk. But at an individual patient level, this information is really not sufficient for us to explain why one person gets a severe CIPN and another doesn't. And so we know that there are multiple contributors to this. And we've done, as part of our program, some studies into a potential genetic risk and also looking at potential biomarkers of risk. So things like metabolism that might be able to explain the variation in outcomes between people. So an important area of our work is trying to get additional cohorts to validate some of these markers that we've found.
And we still continue in a small way to look for therapeutic interventions. We're in the middle of evaluating, possibly beginning at a phase one level, an entirely novel approach. So we try to maintain that kind of principle that we were funded to do for 5 years of looking at all of the aspects of this problem and seeing in a small way what contribution we can make. And then through Susanna, who's very plugged in internationally, to make sure that we understand what other colleagues are doing and look for ways to collaborate.
I think the other element is looking at rehabilitation interventions. While we also look for neuroprotective strategies, so we've recently completed our exercise study, which we're currently analyzing. And one of our colleagues has got a recent grant to implement a new home-based exercise strategy. And that trial is also starting this year. But I think the next step, I guess, of implementing this story about how exercise can benefit patients is how can we put this information into the hands of all patients now. Obviously, research takes a long time for the outcomes to be generated. But I think for things like, you know, improving screening and for things like improving exercise rehabilitation, we need to be able to synthesize this evidence and provide it to patients today so that patients can feel empowered. There's things they can do that possibly might help them today. And this is really speaking to all the patients that have been enrolled in our exercise studies. This is the kind of thing that they say, that they want to make this information available to people so people know, you know, what sort of strategies they could use.
So this is such a nice example of the richness of the field within which you operate, from understanding the mechanisms and epidemiology to developing interventions to implementing evidence to engaging with patients, delivering multidisciplinary care, being timely in delivering that care. These are really important building blocks for CIPN as a problem, but also could be potentially transferable to other conditions. How can we sort of package that knowledge? How can we take it to other conditions? David, you already referred to fatigue, but I would see analogies to frailty or cognitive dysfunction or other symptoms that patients can experience. How can we take this knowledge and adapt it to other conditions? Any advice from you?
So serendipity plays a huge role. So finding colleagues in other areas who want to work with you is the first step and the most important one. And then something I'm fortunate to have two superb collaborators that challenge me and channel me to be productive, because they're so much smarter than I am. So Susanna is one, and you've heard today why. But Phoebe Phillips in pancreas cancer biology is the other. So the first step I had to learn in both cases, in neurology and in basic cell biology, was a new language. And learning each other's language and learning how to work with one another is the first step. And then you need to multiply it by all the other disciplines you want to do that with, is a very important part of successfully moving forward. Susanna and I like to joke that we don't need to actually speak anymore, because we already know what the other person's response is going to be and what our next plan pathway going forward should be. But that takes many years, but it doesn't take that many years to forge the initial collaboration. You both have to be excited, or all of you have to be excited about the problem. There has to be something in it for everyone. There has to be a gain. And I don't just mean financial, I mean intellectually, in the collaboration, because you all get on together. There are a million reasons. For patients, it's about somebody finally wanting to get a solution to what matters to me, for example. And then you have to be creative and you have to be willing to put your shoulder to the wheel, sometimes with no money. And you have to be willing to accept that it won't always work. You will get knocked back and that grants will be hard to get. And sometimes you have to take a step back to take two steps forward. They're kind of motherhood statements, but they really are true. And they reflect in the two areas that I've particularly been collaborating with to find collaborators, how you get to a reasonable place.
Yeah, I think I would also reiterate the joy of collaboration. I think, you know, I've been so lucky to have so many wonderful clinical collaborators as well. Obviously, everyone is really busy. There's a lot of load that you have on your plate, but so many people, you know, that have given their time and knowledge to this topic to, I guess, get it to the point we have today. I still remember the first time I ever met David Goldstein, and I was introduced as a potential prospective PhD student looking at CIPN, and David leant in and said, "Great, when can you start?" And we sort of took off from that point. So I think it's really that enthusiasm from clinicians like David for wanting to change something for their patients and wanting to build collaborations and to really bring people together that has enabled this research in Australia. I think there's a lot more we can do combining across different areas of supportive care research and initiatives that you've created, Bogda. I've really strengthened this, you know, across the whole country and internationally. So, yeah, it's very exciting, I guess, to be part of a dynamic research community like this.
It's lovely to see that at the end of the day, however your neurons travel, it's all very, very human pursued, both for the people that are affected by CIPN and by the people who are your colleagues that you work with. And it is the human quality of curiosity and collaboration and sort of goodwill what really builds both research and practice. So the final question for me, for both of you, just bringing CIPN into the broader field of supportive care, for you as a researcher and clinician, why does supportive care matter?
I'm happy to start this one. I really think that the distinction between supportive care and other forms of cancer care is false. Supportive care is care. It's an integral part of cancer care, and it shouldn't really be separated into a separate basket. I think maybe it needs a rebrand. I guess the philosophy of, you know, person-centric care, this is something that applies to all forms of care. It's important to people. It's important to people's lives. Yeah, that's my two cents.
It's an integral part of curative treatment and palliative treatment is support. And support covers everything. It covers the drugs. It covers the emotional reaction to the initial diagnosis. It covers understanding the problems that arise during and the problems that arise afterwards. And it's a holistic overview of how to make the patient the center of the activity, but also remember that that means it's a whole person. It's not just the blood vessel in which you're injecting the drug or delivering the radiation. It's actually the whole person. If you think of it like that, then as Suzanne has said, supportive care is not supportive care. It's just part of care.
Couldn't have finished on the better note. Thank you very much, Susanna and David. You've given me so much insights into not just what we can do about CIPN, but what truly is the appropriate research and care that really, really makes a difference. So thank you for taking the time to join me today.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much, Bogda. It's been a real pleasure.
That is all for Supportive Care Matters, a podcast created by me, Bogda Kozwara, for researchers, clinicians, policymakers, and patients passionate about improving the lives of people affected by cancer. Thanks to Mark Tai, who composed the original music, and the Oncology Network, our producers. For show notes, go to www.oncologynews.com.au. Subscribe to this podcast at your favorite podcast provider and rate us. It will help others find us.